Hey, everybody. This is Luisa Martinez, and welcome to part two of our interview with heterodox economist Dr. Mitch Green. Mitch is a PhD economist living in Portland. He teaches classes at Portland Community College, and he also researches and works with issues related to energy economics as a research scholar for the Global Institute for Sustainable Prosperity. He's a first-generation college student, anti-imperialist army veteran, lover of dogs, and a parkour enthusiast. Last time we spoke, we talked about the summary between the two visions of economics, right? In mainstream economics, the economy is fundamentally scarce and finite. People are fundamentally self-interested. Markets are necessary to allocate those resources that are scarce and ensure that they're put to the best use. Alternatively, heterodox economics is a social provisioning process where key features of its organization are socially constructed, where resources are produced and not inherently scarce. And this is a far more open and discretionary view of how we structure society. So Mitch, thanks so much for joining us again.
Glad to be here again. I'm super stoked.
So last time we chatted, you made the claim that money is not scarce and can be created to mobilize resources. What would you say to somebody that is trying to purchase something right now, like, for instance, lumber, and cannot because it's either on back order or the price is higher? So wouldn't we consider that inflation, and shouldn't we be worried?
I'm glad you asked that. Like, that's a really valid concern because it's a practical experience that folks have. But it's really important to understand what's causing that issue at a fundamental level. It's not true that deficit spending to, say, get cash to households who need it during the COVID crisis is the cause of those supply chain problems. Rather, what we're seeing now across a range of goods are structural issues inherent in the nature of how those supply chains were constructed, which has been years in the making, which in a sense exposed their lack of resiliency.
Okay, so then can you talk about that a little bit? What do you mean by supply chain problems?
Yeah, so let's look at new cars, for instance. Automakers, firms have had a hard time sourcing some of the key components for an automobile, like semiconductors in particular, to finish new vehicles. And that's due to bottlenecks and constraints in those global supply chains. So what a supply chain is, for folks kind of new to that concept, is it's a representation of a series of discrete production stages that must occur to transform raw materials into finished goods, right? And so every good, every market has supply chains. And so it takes a lot of different steps to get like a semiconductor produced and then ultimately put into a Ford pickup truck. So sometimes there's a lack of investments in key stages, or corporations rely upon maybe a single supplier to furnish a key good. And that gums things up when there's a shock to the system, right? And so the same can be said for lumber. Prices are wild right now for things like plywood or 2x4s because of a decade of underinvestment in milling capacity and some other constraints that have nothing to do with the current crisis. So the business community baked into their long-term expectations the idea that growth was going to remain low in perpetuity following like a very weak and tepid response on a fiscal level to the Great Recession. Okay, remember, we were all very, very austerian during that period of time. So if anything, fiscal prudence itself, like fear of deficits itself, actually created the conditions for the specific supply chain problems we're seeing today.
Okay, so would you say perhaps recently the gas crisis that we see, maybe as a result of people pouring gasoline into trash bags?
Yeah, I mean, I don't even know if that's the same. I mean, that was a situation where there was a hack on a pipeline and they got into the billing system and did a ransomware attack. But like the owners of that pipeline were more worried about how they were going to settle the accounts of those bills. They didn't know how much to bill basically during that period of time. So they just shut the whole pipeline down rather than like deal with like potentially underbilling someone. So that's a related problem. I mean, I would say that that's part of a broader issue when you leave the business of infrastructure up to the private sector to make decisions that affect our welfare as a whole. You get weird, absurd results like that. By the way, kids at home, don't put gasoline in a flimsy plastic bag. It's just going to dissolve through the gasoline, the plastic bag, and then you'll end up with that in your trunk.
While we're at it, I mean, don't put it in a plastic tub. Just don't pour it into large containers and then drive away from the gas station. Would you agree? Is that your professional opinion, Mitch?
Yeah, that's I was willing to stake my reputation on that before I got the PhD.
Oh, okay. That's noble. Okay, so back to the issue at hand. I think I see what you're saying. So what you just said doesn't change the fact that these things are in short supply today, and that sustained deficit spending is only going to aggravate that, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's a tricky problem, right? So you wouldn't want, because you have the conditions right now, so you wouldn't want the federal government to go out tomorrow and just try to outbid the market for resources that are presently hard to come by because of those supply chain problems. But even worse would be like for a retrenchment in the policies that have shored up people's household finances, like, for instance, like cutting unemployment insurance too early, or not pursuing some more bold things that you thought maybe we might do, like student loan forgiveness. Yeah, even though many of us might have been surprised that that was on the table, it seemed like there was a moment where they could actually pull that off in this administration. It would be far worse to like stop short now because you're scared of some early shoots that you think are inflationary, and then drain the private sector of incomes, because it's just going to exacerbate this very problem that got us into where we are today. So it's in a sense kicking the can down the road, and it leaves us back in a world where those low growth expectations were validated. Okay, basically what you need to do, if you put me in the seat right now, you need to convince investors that this boom is real. So they'll go out and they'll build more capacity, right? You need to convince them that growth will remain strong, demand will remain strong for the long haul, and they will invest in more capacity. And building capacity is actually the only way to make scarce resources less scarce.
Okay. So kind of related to taking the concept, you're kicking the can down the road. Working class people identify with how the national economy is framed in the mainstream media, right? So that when we pass budgets to pay for social services or what happens more often is tax cuts for rich people, that we're essentially putting it on a credit card, right? We're kicking the can down the road and we're borrowing against the future. And what you're saying is that heterodox economists argue that if something is technically possible, right? So we could, for instance, technically we have the possibility of ending world hunger or stopping climate catastrophe, and we're at post scarcity, then we can pay for it, right? So can you explain the difference for somebody just learning all this? Like, what is the difference between a personal budget, which is very narrow for the vast majority of people in this country, versus the discretion that's available at the federal level?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And it's a hard one to wrap your mind around, but at the first place you need to start is you have to ask yourself whether or not you are the issuer of a currency or whether you're the user of a currency. So all of us who, you know, the working families, we all have the experience directly as users of the currency. So to pay our bills, we have to sort of go out into the world and somehow earn money in dollars, right? We have to get a job. If we're lucky, we've got some assets that have been gifted to us, maybe because like a wealthy uncle died or whatever. And so like we've got some sort of asset somewhere that brings dollars into our households. And to accumulate dollars over time and save for the future and manage our household budgets in a prudent way, we have to spend less than we bring in. So that's a fundamentally kind of like user of the currency constrained way to view things. But the federal government is completely different than that. It is the issuer of the currency, right? So in order for any of us to save in dollars or spend in dollars, we have to get it from somewhere. And the place that we get it from is the issuer of the currency, and that's the federal government. So in some sense, the federal government can never run out of dollars. Okay. It can always afford to pay its bills in dollars because at the end of the day, every last use of that dollar came from federal spending in the first place. So we have this situation where that distinction matters up front. And so there is there's this relationship when you add it all up and you add all the sector or all the households together, and you come up with a private sector balance, and then you compare that to the public sector balance. Those are sort of mirror images of each other. Okay.
And can so I what, can I wait? Wait. I'm sorry. Could you explain the difference? What do you mean by public sector and private sector balance?
Yeah. So all of us, you and I, you know, folks who are having this conversation, we're worried about making sure we're saving for a rainy day. We are all users of the currency. We are all part of what we call the private sector. Okay. So private actors, just everyday people, make up what we call the private sector in the economy. And then there's another sector which makes up the federal and state and local government section sectors. And so that's sort of like the public sector. Okay, so when you think about public sector versus private sector, when we think about financial balances, we are talking about which side of the ledger they are on. Okay, so if you look at the national debt, for instance, and you see it growing, you want to ask, well, who holds the asset and who holds the liability there? Okay, because there's always two sides of that coin. So, you know, a growing national debt is the same as a growing set of private sector savings. So there's a mirror relationship. It's hazardous to think about, you know, private debt and public debt as not interconnected, because they are, but they're quite different. Okay, so I'll pause there and see if there's like any confusion that I can clear up there. I think that's a really hard one for my students to wrap their brains around, you know.
Yeah. Is there an analogy that you use that maybe clarifies things a little bit better? Or you just take points off? Is that your?
No, actually we do this thing. I don't always do it in my classes, but we used to do this thing where I went to graduate school, and PCC sometimes do it, where it's like a component of your grade is earning like Rubux. So if you're a PCC student, you might have like kangaroo's the mascot, right? So you might have to go out and earn what we're calling Rubux. And the only way to earn that is to go out and like maybe do some community service, or you maybe do a service learning project, and then you get credit in coalition with this like agency you worked with for those hours you worked. And then the only place you can get them though is from me, and I'm the treasurer. So I'm issuing these Rubux that satisfy your obligation to get them. And so in one sense, I'm generating money. We're going to call them Rubux. I am running a deficit against me, and the people who are my students collecting these Rubux to satisfy a part of their grade, and in the process doing like socially useful work, they're collecting a surplus. Okay. And so that balances dollar for dollar. And that's like a way that kind of clicks for the students. It's also a way to like use quasi public institutions to actually get outside of this boundary that we've been talking about. So like, for instance, I've got some friends in upstate New York, who during early on in the COVID crisis tried to convince, the SUNY system to issue like this alternative currency called unis and like float this kind of like thing to kind of keep things going, and then have the Fed buy it up in a very complicated way. And it's all part of this like idea that there are layers of possibility here, but it starts by first recognizing that that there's a difference between a user and an issuer of a currency.
Okay, but at the end of the day, it's all social relationship.
Correct. Right. And there's a hierarchy of acceptability. Like I could write an IOU to you, and you could choose whether or not you want to accept it for something that that you've given me, and like as payment for a thing. But you may want to do that because maybe you heard that I'm like bad at paying my bills, you know? And so it's a question of acceptability and trust. And there's this like nexus of possibility there. But at the very top, whether we like it or not, stands the state. And everyone accepts the state's obligations for a broad set of reasons.
Okay. Well, thanks. I think we'll leave it there. And if you learned anything from this conversation, it's not to pour gasoline into buckets. Would you say that's right, Mitch?
I think that's the most critical lesson of our time.
Okay. Thanks so much.
Yeah.
And we will be back next week with part three of our interview with Dr. Mitch.
Thank you.